I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Stephen from San Diego. You want to come up? Let's do this.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. My name is Stephen. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank South Bay Pioneers, Mike back there, John, for inviting me to be the speaker tonight. This is the longest I'm going to speak. I've never spoken this long, and I've been told I've been given 3 hours to be able to speak. So, guaranteed to put you to sleep. Well, my story started in my mother's womb. I won't go that far. I was born in Bakersfield, California, and I came from a family of modest means. I mean, they weren't rich. They weren't poor. My parents were not educated. And I am the eldest of four, and my parents wanted the best for me. And we were raised Catholic. They sent me to Catholic schools. I went to high school, a Catholic high school. And then after graduation, I considered entering the priesthood, you know. And it was one of those things where that was a good vocation for me. I think I had the personality for it. And at the same time, I had some good mentors in priests that I had known growing up. I went to my first year in the seminary in Fresno, California. And I was taught by the Jesuits. And for those of you that know the Jesuits, I mean, their specialty is education. And they are probably the brightest bunch of men that I've ever known, okay? And as I got to know them, I mean, they're great educators, and my education there for the first year was just phenomenal. I started to notice that, you know, after dinner, they would disappear. And I wondered about that, you know, how come they didn't participate, you know, in Vespers or prayers in the evening. Turns out that they did a lot of drinking. And I discovered that they had an understanding amongst themselves, since they had given their lives for this religious order, that they were entitled to certain things, okay? And one of them was liquor. It was easy to get, and they proceeded to get pretty wasted every night. And and you could see it the next day, you know, early in the morning. If you had an early class, you know, whoever the priest was that was teaching the class, he was a little red-eyed, a little. You could take advantage of him, you know, in some of the answers that that you gave them, and that was the end of that. You know, I became disillusioned with the Catholic Church, and I'm sorry to say that. You know, it's just the impressions that I've had of the priest at the time. I didn't want to be a part of that. And so I didn't go back for my second year. I kind of lost my path and moved back home. I attended some classes at a community college, you know, keep my foot somewhat getting educated. And in February of 1970, I received a draft notice. And I was drafted, and I was requested to report to Fresno, California for induction. So a bunch of us in Bakersfield boarded the bus, went to Fresno, and we got off the bus. And immediately before we got off the bus, this individual who was in the military had a lot of stripes on his sleeve. I didn't know what rank he was or anything like that. And he started barking out orders, and he says, "Now, when you step off the bus, I want you all to line up, you know, in a single file, and then I want five rows, and bo on. So I'm going like, okay, whatever. So I get out. Let me see, I'm 5'8", 125 pounds, and I'm standing in line. Okay, I'm kind of like in the middle of the pack, okay, because I didn't know what the heck was going to go on. All of a sudden, any Marines in here? Veterans? All right, okay. And then in that case, you're going to know what I'm talking about. This guy shows up in his dress blues. Okay, I didn't know what dress blues were. But he, you know, his blue pants with a little stripe on the side, you know, the beige shirt, and he had this drill sergeant hat pulled down over his eyes, and he was a black guy, real thin. I mean, it looked like he could take you down with one hand, you know. So he says, "Attention!" So we're going like, okay. And he's walking down, looking at everybody, you know. And he goes, "You, step out. You, in the back row, step out. And you, way back there, step out. You're now Marines." I was like, whoa. Thank goodness I didn't make the cut. I wasn't the few men that they wanted. Lo and behold, I tested out and became a medic. You know, I finished boot camp. And I think the first thing we did, we went to the non-officers club. And we proceeded to drink a lot of beer. A beer was only 25 cents. And, you know, it was cheap. I think it was making $150 a month. But, you know, it was good times. And that's one of the things that the military kind of taught me, is that there's this team approach to problem solving and the camaraderie. So if you didn't drink, you pretty much were on the outs. So to be part of the team or be part of the group, you needed to drink. So that was my first introduction to it. I probably had a couple of, you know, drunks, but I don't remember them. That was early on. So, and I was really lucky because being a medic, I was able to do different things in the military, and it was, I had various temporary duty stations across the United States. I was stationed in Kentucky, I was stationed in Texas, I was stationed up in Petaluma, California, and that was an interesting station because it was a station, a small group of individuals, and they had studied foreign languages. So it was Chinese, Russian, whatever, and they were listening to radio broadcasts, and they would interpret, you know, anything that was coming across the radio waves, and they would just submit it for, you know, evaluation or whatever. A lot of people getting very depressed, becoming very psychotic, and lucky for me, I didn't have to meet anybody. I think somebody had sprained their ankle, and that was about as serious as it got. So it was. I was pretty lucky, and to visit a place that I later went back to visit, and it's beautiful. It's just, I don't think that duty station's there anymore. I think they've kind of dropped that station. So as I said, I had done multiple duty stations, had been exposed to different cities in the United States, and I was having a great time. It was just like having a job, and every 2 months I would be stationed someplace else. Eventually, I got a duty station in Vietnam, and I was scheduled to be there for 3 months, and I was told that I was going to be opening a drug lab, and that next door there was going to be not a rehabilitation center, but a center that people went to detox. Okay, there was no therapy, there was nothing. You just went there, and it was just like being in a dry tank. You just sat there, you ate, and as soon as you tested, you know, negative, then you're on the next plane out. So these people that were coming there were peeing into a cup, and if they tested positive, you went into the compound, and you didn't leave until you tested negative. And it was a big surprise for a lot of people, because those of you that were in the military, if you know what I'm talking about, a short timer's calendar is you count the days. The last month of your tour, you just count every single day, going like, man, I'm looking forward to going home. I'm looking forward to going home. And my duty station in Vietnam was at Cam Ranh Bay. I had never left the country until then, and Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam is one of the most beautiful places I had ever seen in my life. White sands, you know, green turquoise water, hills that were just green. That was just spectacular. And all the planes that were coming into Vietnam were carrying soldiers, would land in Cam Ranh Bay. And they would also depart, you know, with the full load of soldiers that were returning to the United States. Now, for a lot of the people that were being tested positive and they were clueless. They didn't even know that we had the capability to be able to do that. They got very depressed. A lot of them committed suicide because they were unprepared for that, you know. And I myself, being a young 21-year-old guy, you know, started to see these things and going like, what's really going on here? Well, what really set this up is that a lot of soldiers were returning from Vietnam into the United States addicted to drugs. And the government decided, you know what? We cannot allow that to happen. We need to stop it in Vietnam. So that was the purpose of setting up the laboratory and having the detox there. But some people were really addicted to drugs. And eventually they had to be released, returned back to the United States, and they became part of the VA system. Okay. And what happened, and I discovered this when I got back to the United States, is that they substituted heroin or cocaine for methadone. And methadone is an FDA-approved drug that does exactly the same thing. So it was just substituting one thing for another thing, you know. And they became kind of, you know, wards of the VA system. And I don't know how successful it was, but it was really, for me, a very disappointing thing, what I was really doing. Like I said, I was only supposed to be there for 3 months. And the day I was supposed to return to the United States, I got a severe case of appendicitis. And doctor saw me, says, your appendicitis is or appendix is ready to burst. We're going to have to operate. And I said, okay. And somehow he found out that that was the day that I was supposed to return to the United States. So interesting enough, I woke up on a plane, a medevac plane, coming back to the United States that same evening. And so I was lucky because there was a good possibility that I didn't have a replacement to replace me. But they had me on a jet plane going back to the States, and I arrived in the States. I healed, and my final duty station was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. So I spent a couple of months there. I decided that I was going to apply for university, go back to school, get an education, and try something a little bit different. The Army was not for me. I needed to get out of that situation. So I got discharged on a Thursday, and I was ready to start school on a Monday. And I drove across the United States in 3 days and started school on Monday. And that was, I don't remember much of that trip, to be honest with you. It was fast, it was hard, but I had to be in San Diego. That's where I was accepted. I was accepted at one of the very first classes here at UCSD. So I got here, started to go to school, and I got my bachelor's. At UCSD. I then got a master's at the University of California, Irvine. And then I was lucky enough to get a year, postgraduate year, to go to the University of Barcelona in Spain. And that was wonderful. That was another exposure of me being able to see a culture that I had a little bit of understanding, but it was just, wow. How do I explain it? Just an incredible experience. Culture, food, language, the whole works. And I coming from Bakersfield, when it was a little town, and I still consider it a little town, I think it's got 500,000 people now. But nonetheless, my mentality of what the world was very limited. And I knew I needed to get a job that allowed me to be able to travel. And so I started my business career. And I started working for large biomedical device companies, okay? And the first one that I went to work for was Edwards Laboratories. And Edwards Laboratories is the world's largest manufacturer of heart valves, okay? You wouldn't know that unless you had a heart valve from them, okay? So I went to work for them for several years, and in about 12 years, you know, into my career, I worked for different biomedical companies, you know, learning what they were doing and how to do it right, or maybe not the right way, or I would do it differently if I had that opportunity. And at the end of the 12 years, I decided that I wanted to start up my own biomedical company. So we formed a team of people. We started a company, medical devices, and it took a little while. Okay, it didn't happen overnight. We worked very, very hard, and there were times when we thought we were going to have to close the doors. We were just weren't selling enough products. We weren't getting the breaks from the FDA. Things just weren't going our way. But we had one product that really started to take off in sales. And lo and behold, a large biomedical company acquired us, okay, made life comfortable. And they asked me to stay around for about 3 years. And so I stuck around for 3 years. And they said, if I stuck around for 3 years, they would double my salary. And I said, why not? I got nothing else better to do. So I stuck around with them, traveled around the United States, traveled to different countries around the world. And after the 3 years, I decided that I didn't want to work for a large company anymore. So an opportunity came up, another one, about starting another company with some of the team members that we had started the first company with. And this was a heart valve company. And I'm going to show you what that heart valve is. It's this. Okay, this is what it looked like. I would pass it around, but it's $1 million. So I'm just going to, if you want to see it afterwards, I'd be happy to describe how it works and how it was implanted. This changed everything in open heart surgery. With this device, I didn't have to crack your chest open. I could simply pass a catheter up your leg, okay, release this valve in your aortic position, and you have a brand new valve in 15 minutes. Even mechanics can't replace your valves in 15 minutes. Okay? And it's only $30,000. And you think, boy, that's a lot of money. And I tell you, when we introduced it, it was a lot of money. But when you start to doing the math about the individuals that this was focused on, we're talking about elderly patients. And you know, in the medical community, they're not going to do anything for you as pre-treatment. They're going to have to wait till something gets really bad, and then they decide it's time to do something. Well, by that time, you've already deteriorated. You're not going to, you know, be jumping up and down and, you know, moving around real quick. And so the average age of our patients at this time was about 82 years of age. And the amazing thing is that I remember the very first case we did. The patient went in. We saw the patient in the morning. And the patient was an elderly lady. She was 85 years old. And she was laying in bed. Her head was a little bit propped up. And she was the color of gray. She was ashen gray. And she was huffing and puffing. And I'm going like, wow. Took her into the lab. We did the procedure. It took several hours. I mean, it took years to get to 15 minutes, but in the early days, it took several hours because it took a lot of, you know, control and preparation and everything else. Within an hour of the procedure, the lady was in the same bed, propped up, pink, talking and asking when she could go home. It was amazing. It was amazing. And the reason, you know, it sounds like, you know, $30,000 was a lot of money. When you do open heart surgery can run anywhere from $150,000 to $250,000. Okay? You don't know that until it happens to you and you get the bill. And hopefully you have insurance and they pay for it. The whole idea of doing this is to reduce the amount of recovery time, because that's where they got you. If you're in the hospital as an elderly patient and you have complications, you're going to be there for several days, possibly weeks, maybe even a month, maybe never leave the hospital. I mean, that's how serious this operation is. But with this, we could have you out in 24 hours. It changed everything, okay? And I was traveling all over the world. I was traveling to Europe. I was traveling to South America, Australia, New Zealand. For the first 2 years, I was gone over 300 days a year, either hotels, airplanes. I mean, I'm a multi-million miler. I have multi-millions in hotel rooms. I mean, I think my wife and I have stayed in hotels for free for as long as I can remember. And I'm still living off of those miles, you know, really. But at the same time, you probably suspect that, you know, I am married. I never had children. Okay, we never had children because of my schedule. It wouldn't have been fair to my wife, you know, to be gone such a long period of time, come home and have Johnny hand it to me and say, I've had enough of this, man. I need a break, you know, type of thing. And I don't think my wife and I were really ready for that. And I don't know if I would have been a really good father. You know, I probably today, I think I would be a good father. But at that moment in time, I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't prepared for it. I didn't even know what it would be like, you know. And I lived vicariously through my siblings and their children and seeing some of the drama that they had to go through, some of the successes, some of the happiness that they've had. I'm very happy for them. Okay, but it's not for everybody. So that was my second startup, and they too asked me to stick around for 3 years. They didn't double my salary, but that's okay. What they did give me was basically a carte blanche expense account, so I could continue to travel around the world, staying at 5-star hotels, eating at 5-star restaurants, drinking to my content. I mean, basically, it was free candy, you know, and the candy store was mine, and I could eat as much as I want. It wasn't a good situation. That was really my start to getting inducted into alcoholism, and it started then. Okay, it was free, and it was part of the part of doing business. Now, when I was with this company, I was treated like royalty. I mean, I was considered, they call me a legacy employee. They call me a rock star. And yeah, my ego really kind of fed off of that, you know. And at the same time, you know, when I told them that I was going to retire at 62, and that I was going to be leaving the company. And they go, why would you leave this company? God. You know, and I'm saying, yeah, you're right. You know, why would I leave it? I mean, I love what I do. I mean, you guys are paying me to do what I want to do, to travel and eat and drink and, you know, to my content. And but I said to them, you know, there's other things in life. I want to be able to travel and experience things, and something that I hadn't done on a leisurely basis. You know, not flying in one night and flying out the next night. Just that's not a holiday or a vacation. So I left that company and I looked forward to retirement. I started taking classes in things that I'd be interested in, like music and dancing and cooking. I became a good cook. They gave me back my dancing lesson money and told me that I had two left feet. And I tried it for a year, but to be honest with you, I knew the steps, but it was mechanical. It wasn't. I didn't feel it, and that was the problem. I couldn't hear the music, and even today, I really struggle. I love watching people dance. I can't. And it's one of the things that I am very, very fearful of. Is don't ask me to dance, please. Okay. So, there I am. And I started to do these things. And I also started to do some volunteer work for it's called Wilderness Volunteers. And they do work for the National Park System. It's called trail maintenance. But I love working with my hands. I love being outdoors. And it was just a terrific experience. Okay. But doing these things or doing them, I was always drinking. Okay. And a lot of times the people didn't know I was drinking. You know, and they would have dinner, but I already had a couple of drinks, and I started to allow it to get out of control. And I would come home and proceeded to drink, and it evolved very quickly. I mean, from the time from 62 to 65, things started to happen. And I remember going out one night at a bar and having a lot to drink and coming home and fumbling with the key and in the lock, and my wife opens the door. She's standing there. And it's just like out of a Marvel comic book, man. Her hair's on fire. Fire's coming out of her eyes. And I'm going, I'm screwed, man. She looks at me. She goes, you've been drinking. And I go, yes, I have. And she says, honestly, you know, you have a problem. We talked about this before. But I've had enough. And you have two choices. One, you can continue doing what you're doing, and I'm not going to be a part of this anymore. Okay, you're on your own. Or two, you can get some help. And I don't know how to help you. You're going to have to find out on your own. So, and she said, and by the way, you don't live here anymore until you decide which of those choices you got. So, since I live in downtown San Diego, it's easy to get a hotel room. So, I went and got a hotel room for a couple of days. You know, the first day, nothing changed. You know, the witch is dead. I'm happy. You know, by the third day, which is on a Monday, I realized, man, this is not good. I hit rock bottom, and I don't know what to do. So I called my primary physician, and I said, I think I have a problem. He says, come on in, let's talk about it. So I went in, talked about it, and he asked me how many drinks I had, and I said, I drink too much. I black out. Every night's become a blackout. I can't remember conversations I had with my wife. I don't remember conversations I had with friends. I don't remember movies that I went to. I don't remember parties that I went to. I was blacking out every single day. And I was drinking from morning to night. And I can't tell you, I would black out twice in a day. It got stupid real quick. And he says, well, you know what? I think we're going to have to put you in rehab. And I said, I agree. So I went into rehab. And they gave me a bunch of drugs to kind of, you know, help me come down. And and I felt good. They gave me a big book, just like that one. I attempted to read it and go like, wow. Mine was in Chinese. At least it felt like it, because I didn't understand a word it said. And I went to my very first AA meeting. And it was wall-to-wall people. And the people started sharing their stories. And I'm sitting in the back in the aisle of denial going like, what are these people talking about? I mean, oh my God. I mean, lost jobs, DUIs, incarceration, lost marriages, lost families. That's not me. I've not had any of that happen yet, you know. And so I didn't get it. I did not get it. And that's okay. You know, finally, when I was discharged from rehab, they said, you know, you ought to go to more AA meetings. You know, it's very rare for somebody to pick it up right away. You need to be exposed to different kinds of meetings. And so when I got discharged, I went to go see my therapist. Okay. And lo and behold, he had AA meetings in the clinic that he was at. So I would go to meetings there and from patients and people who brought in, you know, their stories to share. And once again, I was going like, this is not me. I'm not part of this, you know. I might be an alcoholic, but this stuff has not happened to me. You know, I got to be, I got to find a place where I find equals, you know. I just didn't understand that the underlying problem was the same. It was alcohol and drugs, okay? And they ran hand in hand. You know, I mean, when I was doing alcohol, I was smoking pot, and I can't tell you how much pot I smoked and how much I drank. It just kept going and going and going until I blacked out. It just doesn't work. So I went to AA meetings. That's all I did. In fact, one of the very first ones that I came to was right here at South Bay Pioneers. I don't remember it quite as much as this, but it was good. Once again, it wasn't me, but I kept going to meetings. And my therapist one day said to me, you know, Stephen, there's a meeting up at Mount Soledad in La Jolla. It's all men's, and it's a speaker meeting. And I said, yeah, I'll go. So I go up. It was up on a hill, pretty close to where the cross is at a church, and parked my car Saturday morning, 9 o'clock, walking up, and a bunch of people are laughing and talking, and I'm walking up, you know, and it's a lot of men, okay? And immediately somebody comes out, you know, and, you know, reaches out their hand to me and says, you know, welcome, welcome. You know, and tells me their name, and I tell him my name, and he says, here, let me introduce you, you know, really. Just introducing, and they attempt to hug me, and yeah, I was going like, whoa, this is a little too fast for me, you know? And I'm going like, oh my God, it's a gay AA meeting. I'm at the wrong place. Didn't understand it, you know? Sat in that meeting, and Roger was there, stunned. I was like a deer in the headlights, man. I'm going like, what the hey is going on here? I listened, and eventually I started to get a little bit. I started to understand what was really going on. And it wasn't about me. It was about everybody else that was in the room sharing, you know, their trials and tribulations as to how they got there, how they got out of it, and how they're much happier. And I kept going back. And Roger was the one that introduced me to my first sponsor. We started working the steps slowly. And that was due to my fault. You know, I just didn't want to jump in first, you know, feet first. And the problem I had, and this was the using the term God. And I had a problem way when I was a young man, you know. Remember being in the seminary, having what I interpreted as what God was? And I struggled with it. I struggled with, you know, the second and third step for a whole year before I could advance. And one day, a very good friend of mine, I would call him an elder statesman in AA, pulled me aside and he says, do you have a problem with the concept of God? I said, yes, I do. He says, Stephen, he says, God is a group of drunks. And at that moment, I had an epiphany. Because I was going to meetings, and sometimes I would walk out of that meeting and have like a high, you know, that I was part of the group. I couldn't quite define what that was, okay? But when he said that, you know, it just came together. Everything came together that it was a God or a power greater than myself that would allow me to be able to advance. I couldn't do this on my own. This is a we program. It took me a year to figure that out, kicking and screaming. Once I had gotten past that point, doing the rest of the steps became fairly easy, okay? And I was able to complete the 12 steps in 2 years. Thank goodness, you know, there isn't a race or a completion date to do the 12 steps, but I was able to do it. And wow, it's been an incredible journey. You know, I've had sponsees. I've been humbled. I've been frustrated, you know, with that experience. And I'm sure those of you who have had sponsees can understand that, because they don't pay attention. They don't want to advance themselves. They don't want to stay in the program. And I've only had one, you know, in the many sponsees that I've had, you know, actually complete the 12 steps and stay in the program. Everybody else moves away, thinks that they can do it on their own, don't go to meetings and get further and further away. And all of a sudden, you're experiencing, let me do an experiment. You know, I've been sober for a year or two. Let me see if I can have one drink. And I've never been there. I now understand that I cannot go there. One leads to two, two leads to three, and I'm off to the races. Right back where I left off, and maybe even worse. I don't want to know what it's like, okay? I'm happy where I'm at today because of the program. The program has saved my life, has saved my marriage. I've been married 45 years. I know. I could have been out of prison by now. And it's been a wonderful journey. Okay, I my wife and I do a lot of serious talking. I guess, you know, it took 45 years for me to kind of recognize that she's the love of my life, and we've been up and down, but we stuck it together, you know. And she accepted me back, you know. Not willingly in the beginning, but eventually understood that I could be trusted. You know, I mean, I was a bad boy when I was drinking, and I was doing some bad things. And I had to share those things with her, and it was very humiliating, and I apologized to her, you know, completely. And it's been just a wonderful journey. Now, something that happened recently, okay, last year at this time, I was knocking on death's door. I had been diagnosed with rectal cancer. And I really believe that that was due to my drinking. I drank a lot of gin. And if you drink straight alcohol, you're going to do some damage. And I think I did some damage, serious damage, but I didn't feel it. You know, they discovered it on a colonoscopy and said, look like you've got cancer. You know, we want to operate. If we operate, you're going to get a colostomy. If you don't know what a colostomy is, I can show you. It's not a gun, but it's a little bag that's attached to me. Okay, and I said, no, I don't want that. You know, I love to travel. I think that would be an imposition. I just don't want to go there, man. He says, okay, we're gonna do radiation, and we're gonna do chemo. I said, okay, less invasive. So we started. Okay, and for the first weeks of radiation, every single day, I would take the trolley up to La Jolla, get my treatment, and afterwards, I would sit up. The technicians, the nurses would come in, you know, and said, well, we're done for the day. And I said, are you guys really doing anything? Because I don't feel anything. All I hear is these noises coming out of this machine. I see the lights flashing. But, you know, are you just out there just pumping money and going like, okay, we did this procedure. We're going to charge them, you know, $2,000 and everything will be okay. And he said, oh, no, hang on. Wait another week. Okay. Boy, then it started. I wasn't feeling good. I mean, I would go in, have the procedure, immediately go home and just go to bed. I was exhausted. Completely exhausted. So my oncologist asked me to take a two-week break between radiation and chemo. At the end of the two-week period, I was in no condition to start chemo. I was in bad shape, okay? So she gave me an additional 2 weeks, so I had a month in between the treatments. Started radiation. Wow. The very first day they come in, I mean, it's this bag that the nurses are carrying with, you know, these gloves that are specialized that are putting it on this, you know, rack with tubes coming out of it and sticking needles in me. And it goes into my arm. And within 2 hours, my arm swells up about this big. And I'm buzzing the nurse going, I think I have a problem. And she goes, yes, you do. And she says, and I said, are we going to have to start all over again? She goes, no, we'll just go in your other arm. And I go, oh, do you really have to? She goes, yes. So lucky there was only another hour left, stuck that arm, and it just started to swell up when it was over. And I'm going, great, this is not good. So I go home, once again, just go to bed, and the next week, come back in. At that point, the pain starts to set in, okay? And I'm in and out of the emergency room. the doctors can't figure out what is going on. And one week I'm in the emergency room and this little Asian physician comes out. She's about 5 feet tall and she's a gastroenterologist. She says, I'm going to do a colonoscopy on you because we need to figure out what's going on. And I said, it's about time because I'm in a lot of pain. And I, at that time, I wasn't under morphine, and my wife was kind of, you know, dictating how much I could get. And luckily, you know, I can count on her, you know, to kind of dole it out to me. If it was me, I'd be taking the whole bottle at one time. It would not have been good. So the physician goes in, does the colonoscopy, you know, comes in later that afternoon, sits down with me and says, I have some bad news. Says, you have a hole in your rectum. And I said, yeah, I know that. She goes, no, you have another hole, a big hole in your rectum. And I'm going like, no, you're kidding me. She goes, no, you were burned with radiation. And that's where the pain is coming from. The next day, I had a colostomy, okay? And the day after that, the pain went away, you know? So I have a colostomy now, okay? And they said, well, this is just temporary, you know, because we're gonna take out your rectum, we're gonna take out your prostate, and we're gonna take out your bladder. I see, well, wait a minute, in that case, I'm gonna be a two-bagger, you know, one for poop and one for pee, you know? I go, no, let's not do that, okay? Let's just, I'll keep the one-bagger. And that's what I've done. You know, I've accepted the fact that I'm a one-bagger. And I'm still able to travel. I've had a couple of incidents that have happened to me that were a little embarrassing, but luckily I was able to get out of the situation. One of them was on a flight to Europe, and luckily I was able to fix myself, you know, in the bathroom, and the stewardesses were knocking on the door and asking me if I needed any help. I said, no, I'm well under control, but you might not want to let anybody use this restroom for the rest of the flight. But you know, as this episode in my life was happening, I had brothers in AA who were reaching out to me every single day. I don't remember a lot of the conversations. It's just that my wife would tell me that so-and-so called and wanted to see how you were doing, you know, if there was any improvement, if there was anything that they could do for you. And I remember that. I remember them asking me, what can I do to help you? And I said, there's nothing that you can do. You know, really, it's all on me. It's in God's hand. I'm not in control. All I hope to do is to get, you know, better and be able to do the things that I want to do. And for that, I am eternally grateful for that brotherhood, for that camaraderie. You know, the friends that I never had, I now have in AA. It's just, they're alcoholics, you know, and they understand exactly what I went through. So with that, I came out of it. I continue to travel. My wife and I are leaving for Europe in a couple of weeks. This time I'm prepared for any little thing that happens, but once again, if it does happen, you know, I'll deal with it. It's a situation that I'm not in control of. And you know, here I stand in front of you, and it was those words that my brothers, you know, said to me about what can I do to help you is powerful, and I use it today. You know, with anybody who I see is struggling, what can I do to help? All you need to do is just ask, and I'm there. You know, I am currently the happiest I have ever been in my life. It took a lifetime to get here. And the program helped me understand that happiness. You know, yesterday was really an incredible day. Like I said, I've been married, you know, 45 years. And sometimes I get a little annoyed with my wife because, you know, I put the dishes in the dishwasher, turn it on, And, you know, it's her turn to unload the dishwasher and put the dishes away and stuff like that. And we have a little dog, okay, who has toys, and they're just like kids. They're all over the house. I decided I'm going to pick them up, put them in the basket, get them out of the way, you know, mop the floors, sweep this, you know, vacuum that. And then, you know, my wife gets home after doing her nails and everything and goes, doesn't even notice it. Doesn't notice a thing. And I'm thinking, like, why doesn't she notice it? I mean, boy, she's being ungrateful. And I'm going, like, you are such a dummy. I mean, she's not doing this on purpose. She's not doing this to aggravate you. You know, you're much happier when you're able to do this yourself. So shut up, you know, and do it. Be happy. It took me this long to figure it out. It'd be easier for me, and I'd be a lot happier if I just did it. Okay? Leave it be. Okay? She's a lot happier. And today she goes, I was going to empty out the dishwasher. And I was going, sarcastic me, goes like, what, 2 weeks from now? Where are the other dishes going to go? So anyway, you know, I am sober. I love helping other people. I am the treatment chair for San Diego County and Imperial County for all H&I, for all treatment centers. So it's fun, you know, it's fun giving back to an organization that really has saved my life, okay? And in closing, you know, I want to read something to you, and you probably heard this before, but it's AA's Responsibility Declaration. And it states, I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. I am truly blessed and fortunate to be here. And thank you very much. And God bless all of you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Stephen, thank you so much for sharing with us. Please come back again. One more time for Stephen.